From the Center for European Reform, this is the CER podcast.
Posons-nous sérieusement la question de l'avenir que nous voulons et ayons tous ensemble le courage de le construire.
Für uns in Deutschland ist das Bekenntnis zum vereinten Europa Teil unserer Staatsräson.
A strong united Europe is a necessity for the world because an integrated Europe remains vital to our international order.
This is the moment for Europe to lead the way towards a new vitality.
Hello and welcome to the Centre for European Reforms podcast. I'm Octavia Hughes, host of today's episode, and I'm joined by Sander Todwar, senior economist here at the CER, and by Shaheen Vali, senior research fellow at the German Council on Foreign Relations. Today we'll be discussing Germany's economic entanglements with China, a topic on which the two of you have recently published several papers. So the Commission and the Germans are at loggerheads over China policy. Encouraged by the US, von der Leyen wants to push ahead with the economic security strategy, which would seek to limit the export of advanced technologies to China. But Germany worries that the Commission is trying to grab new powers and that it could provoke a trade war with China. The Germans also dislike the Commission's probe into Chinese exports of electric vehicles. So to start us off, why is Germany's economic relationship with China so important, both for the country itself and for the EU?
Thanks, Octavia. Yeah, I think maybe it's useful to start with a big picture. So if you look for the past few decades at the German economic growth model and the European industrial hinterland that supplies it, it has relied on demand from China and the United States because Germany runs a huge trade surplus, energy from Russia, a well-known story, and you might also add sort of security for trade routes provided by the Pax Americana world order. And this is one of the points that Mario Draghi has been making in the run-up to his report on the European economy later this year. And I think it's helpful to take a step back to think about why Germany is so central to this relationship with China in particular, because its relationship really is quite unique compared to other European countries. If you look at Germany's export dependence, more than 3 or 3.5% of German GDP depends on selling products to China. Its import dependence is also mildly higher than the other G7 advanced economies, but not crazily so. But if you look at foreign direct investment, Germany is really the main driver of FDI into China. It has been for a long time. And basically over the last 20 years, you may even argue that essentially Berlin has outsourced counter-cyclical fiscal policy to the Communist Party in China. So in the mid-2000s, when the German economy wasn't doing well, one of the reasons it picked up is because China basically started developing and there was a lot of demand for German cars and chemicals and machinery. And the same thing happened after the global financial crisis. And so these two economies were very complementary, essentially. Germany producing the kinds of goods that China needed for its development and China producing a lot of demand that Germany needed to grow. But now the world has fundamentally changed and in several key dimensions. One is just the political reality that given the Russian invasion of Ukraine and China's tacit support for that, I think Europeans are more wary of Chinese power. But the second major, more economic change is that the German economic model has gone from complementary to a sense of competition with China. So China now produces cars, machines, chemicals in ever larger quantities, and it's also producing them for exports. And so these two economies are much more on a collision path than they were before. And maybe the third factor that's worth mentioning here is that China has a lot of problems at home. They've had a huge real estate bubble that popped, and the response so far seems to be for all the state-led investment flows to be redirected into further overproduction of the types of advanced industrial goods that Germany excels at. And so these imbalances in China, its trade surplus has basically doubled. The EU's trade deficit with China has almost tripled. And so Germany is faced with a kind of fundamental choice if they're willing to absorb all these Chinese exports or deindustrialize to a certain extent.
Thanks, Sander. So the European Commission is trying to reduce Europe's dependence on China under the slogan of de-risking. What is this de-risking agenda all about, and how did it emerge from the transatlantic relationship?
Well, the term de-risking is fairly new and has been coined the first time by the president of the European Commission in a context where the American administration, under the leadership of its national security advisor, Jake Sullivan, gave the impression of trying to decouple the U.S. economic relationship from China. And I think in the minds of the Commission, sort of de-risking was a less intense version of decoupling. The problem is that the reference to these terms lacked a bit of substance and lacked a clear definition of, you know, how does de-risking compare to decoupling. So what Sander and I in these papers have tried to do is to try and provide some clarity as to what a true de-risking strategy would require. And in our sense, you know, it requires a real integration of a broad set of policies and a set of policies that, you know, may require action at the national level, but also very importantly at the European level. And what we came to find out and question was whether the EU, you know, behind the slogan or behind the demands of a de-risking agenda, had actually a policy framework in place to deliver on that. And our conclusions was that actually the EU lacked a cohesive and coherent policy framework to achieve the sort of de-risking it declared.
Thanks, Shaheen. So in your work, you also identify several key areas of risk to Germany from its dependence on China. Could you briefly talk us through those?
Yeah, sure. So I think we just laid out in short the history of where Germany came from in China, and those risks are very much related to that. So we identify three key ones. The first is that European and particularly German intellectual property is vulnerable in China. So the kind of know-how on how to produce advanced machinery or cars. And German companies really plowed FDI and knowledge into the Chinese market, which in part they were forced to because the Chinese government basically set that as a standard for German firms to be allowed into the market in the first place. And as a result, there wasn't really much regard for strategic interests or a level playing field on the side of politics, or let's say the peak of the globalization era. And so there is now a real risk, essentially, that has already materialized to an extent that Chinese firms have leapfrogged maybe decades of research and development and emerging as a formidable competitor as a result. So that's sort of one. And then the second, I would say, major risk is on the import side. And I think many of our listeners will have seen all the fretting in the West about Europe's dependence on Chinese production of solar panels and other green industrial goods. We're not entirely convinced that that's where Germany's key dependence is. In fact, if you look at low carbon technology, Germany still has an export surplus with China, but there are pockets of real vulnerability. And one that stands out is basically computer chips, so semiconductors and some rare earth materials and other raw materials where China basically and Taiwan. And so potential conflict between the two would be detrimental for Germany. If you think of chips, almost half come from China and Taiwan. And even China itself makes up almost 40% of Germany's direct imports of lower end semiconductor devices. And so all of that's really key for German industry. And in fact, due to the supply chain disruptions in the pandemic, Germany already built probably more than 1 million cars less than it could have done. And so that's a kind of shot across the bow warning sign. And then the third key risk, which is very specific to Germany in some respect, is that its export sector is really reliant on China in some areas. And that is also very concentrated in certain areas of Germany and certain sectors. And so basically, Germany is very exposed to a China shock. Its 2 million workers in the car sector are very exposed. And if you look across these three sectors, the EU is also an important dimension of this because Germany is at the heart of the European economy. It's profoundly integrated in the European economy. And these various dependencies may actually be much bigger if you think through the cascade risks via indirect exposures. So for example, just as a very rough proxy, Germany's import dependence on China is up to 20% higher if you just think of the Netherlands and Poland, which then have firms that basically plug into the German supply chain, but also import from China. So I think these are some of the key risks. So the loss of intellectual property, imports, in particular semiconductors, and exposure to China shocks, given Germany's very elevated export exposure to the Chinese market.
And if I may add something, I also think that the dependency on energy imports remains. So, you know, it has changed in nature because Germany has stopped importing natural gas directly flowing from Russia. But that source of import has been replaced by liquefied natural gas imported from the US or from the Middle East. And so that dependency, so long as the energy transition of Germany is not complete, remains a very important source of vulnerability. So one thing that we stress as well is that, you know, a structurally higher and more volatile energy price in Europe in general and in Germany in particular creates a vulnerability in particular for the energy intensive sector. And I think that's one that Germany might be on its way to free itself from, but that has not occurred yet. And this remains a question mark, which is in fact highly dependent on how quickly Germany can decarbonize its industry.
Thanks. So you briefly touched on this, but what more can Berlin and Brussels do to mitigate the risks that China poses to the German economic model?
I would say, you know, there needs to be a policy framework in place. The European Commission has issued recently an economic security strategy that I think rightly highlights the sort of policy levers that needs to be activated to deliver on that de-risking strategy. And I think what we're finding out in looking at this economic security strategy is that a lot of the policy levers are sitting somewhere in between the member states and the European Commission. Just to name a few, export controls of either dual use or strategic technologies are something that are probably necessary for the EU to advance its de-risking strategy. And as Sander was alluding to protect its intellectual property in certain sectors, for instance. But there is no European view and there is no European policy on export controls. In fact, export controls remain a national prerogative. Investment screening, whether they be outward investment screening, so foreign direct investment from German companies into China, for instance, remain a purely national competence, which, you know, might excite also intra-European tensions, because, you know, if one country decides to ban investment in another country in certain sectors and the country next door in Europe is enabled to do it, that creates questions of level playing field inside a single market. So Europeanizing outward investment screening could be a potentially very important lever, and that is one that so far member states are very reluctant to consider. Inward investment screening as well. I think we've lived in Europe through very baroque situations whereby Chinese investment in the port of Piraeus in Greece, for instance, was not only accepted but welcome in many other ports in Northern Europe as well. But when it came to investing in the port of Hamburg, Germany, this became a national security issue, which was rejected by intelligence agencies in Germany and questioned by the government. And so the fact that, you know, from one country to the next, there is a different definition of what is a national security threatening investment eventually creates a real issue of coherence and cohesiveness. So I think our message is that the tools at the European level exist, but their effectiveness is seriously undermined by the fact that decision-making for these remain, you know, in between the Commission and the member states. And what we advocate is a sort of a real Europeanization of these policy instruments. And then, you know, that needs to be articulated as well with national policies and even in some cases with local lender policies in the case of Germany. And that sort of, you know, integration of all levels of government into a coherent de-risking strategy is still missing.
Thanks, Shaheen. So if these risks are so high, why does Germany not seem to see them? And why is there significant resistance to de-risking in Germany? Is Berlin afraid to trigger a trade war with China?
Yeah, I think they are, but I'm always wondering whether the trade war is not already upon them, whether Berlin likes it or not. I mean, from a purely imbalances perspective, it is, I think, unequivocally clear that the Chinese economy is once again going towards very large imbalances, where essentially they export their problems at home quite literally by plowing so much capital into overproduction of manufactured goods, which they then sell quite cheaply to the rest of the world. And that's not a purely market-driven or comparative advantage story. That's simply a very large imbalance. And so to my mind, not reacting seems like a strange policy path. Maybe there's a degree of denialism in that. And it probably also is reflective, I think, and it picks up nice and Sheen's point. I think China will exploit some of the sort of natural differences that there are between European partners, because, and this is of course true, is that, for example, France has no major automotive exposure in China, or certainly much smaller than Germany. And I think sort of best way to think through Germany's recalcitrance to address some of these issues and to try to build a de-risking toolkit and to stand up a bit more to China has to do with domestic political economy. There are basically two views of the world. One is what I always call the market capitalization view of the world, which is just think of multinationals and their bottom line. The other view is the GDP view of the world, which is where stuff actually produced. And I think that explains a bit the German attitude, because some of Germany's multinationals now produce a lot in China for the Chinese market. And so their bottom line would probably be hurt by further trade tensions. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it maps perfectly to, you know, the workers in Bavaria or northwestern Germany. And so that's the GDP view of the world. And I think there's a tension there within German politics to listen to their firms on the one hand, that to some degree may be partly Chinese now, and to listen to their workers and concerns at home. And I'm curious to see if that shift as the China shock unfolds and hammers into the German economy, because the German economy has been stagnating for the last 4.5 years, in our view, in part because of this Chinese issue. And there's many other issues at play, including energy and the fiscal policy that's too tight. But I think the dynamic may change as we go forward.
In fact, if I may add just something, you've seen some German corporates do even more than what Sender has described by, in fact, arguing that the best way for them to de-risk China was actually to double down on their investments in China. And I think that's a very interesting reaction, which squares with what Sender was describing, but in fact is liable to increase the risks. And I think that, you know, will crystallize in some of the European discussions that are coming up on the introduction of tariffs on some Chinese goods, in particular electric vehicles, for instance.
Exactly. In some respects, Germany has turned a bit into one of its national literary heroes, which is Faust, who sought ever greater power through industry, but then as a result became ever more vulnerable. And I think there's some of that at play here in this relationship.
That's very interesting. So how are France and the other European partners looking at the EU-China de-risking strategy? Are they more worried than Berlin?
I think they're more worried, but what's striking, I find, is that even a country like France, which has, under President Macron, strongly advocated the idea of Europe's strategic autonomy and the need to reduce economic risks and dependencies, even France is quite reluctant to Europeanize some of the policy levers that we've mentioned earlier. So, you know, France is not particularly keen on Europeanizing export controls, not particularly keen on Europeanizing fully inward and outward investment screening. So there is a bit of a tension here where France would be, I think, amenable to introducing tariffs on a wide range of Chinese imports, starting with electric vehicles, but not necessarily so keen to pull together a fully coherent and cohesive and unified under the European Commission set of de-risking policies. And I think that's the mystery of Europe's inconsistency, which is not only driven by disagreements on substance, which I think is the case of some parts of the German establishment influenced by the German corporate view, but also others who see the economic risks but are reluctant to agree to the transfer of economic powers and sovereignty to the Commission that are necessary to address these risks.
Thanks both for joining me on the podcast today, and thanks also to our listeners at home. Make sure to subscribe to us on your preferred podcasting platform, and see you next time.
Thank you for listening to the CER podcast. If you have any feedback for us or want to leave suggestions for a future episode, then you can find us on Twitter at CER_EU.